You know, if it was me as a 20-something Australian over the North Pacific on behalf of the Americans monitoring a dozen or so thermonuclear weapons pointed at American cities, it's quite an awesome responsibility and circumstances to be in.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place for first-hand Cold War history accounts. And make sure you hit that follow button in your podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. Lee joined the Royal Australian Air Force in 1978 to train as a pilot, but was scrubbed after a few months and transitioned to training as an air electronics officer. He flew on the P-3C Orion and was employed on operations in the Indo-Pacific region on maritime patrol surveillance. These included the usual surface surveillance of the region and operations alongside the US against Soviet submarines transiting the area. He also had the opportunity to track Soviet nuclear missile submarines in the Northeast Pacific with the US Navy. He details many incidents during his career, including an archaeological mission, accidentally causing a diplomatic incident, as well as monitoring the splashdown and recovery of re-entry vehicles used to test the heat tiles for the Soviet Buran space shuttle. The Orion served with the Royal Australian Air Force for an incredible 55 years, from 1968 to 2023. I'm delighted to welcome Lee Collins to our Cold War conversation.
As a kid, I was always interested in aviation and the military. I played with Airfix kits, and I had a G.I. Joe and Action Man and all that sort of thing. So, my brother was about 6 years ahead of me, but he was in the Air Cadets, and my other brother, he joined the Air Cadets as well, the Air Training Corps, as it was at the time. And I then joined after them. But while I was still in the Cadets, you know, my oldest brother joined the Air Force initially as a navigator flying on Neptunes in Townsville. Neptune Maritime Patrol aircraft, and then as being a cadet, I actually was able to use that status to actually get a couple of flights in a Neptune while I was on holidays with him up in Townsville in northern Queensland. So that got my first interest in the Air Force as a possible career, but also the whole concept of maritime patrol and going up in something like the old Neptune, which isn't far removed from a World War II two-engine bomber. It really got the juices flowing.
What were your aspirations to work on maritime patrol as a pilot or some other member of the crew?
The maritime patrol one was kind of secondary. I was always very just keen to be a pilot, as I guess most people are. So actually, I applied about three times. In fact, I applied a year before I was old enough to join the Air Force, because the Navy took people as pilot training a year younger. So I applied there, and they said, yeah, come back next year and we'll see what we think of you. But I eventually got on pilot's course after about three selection boards, and then. As luck would have it, I lasted about 3 months on course, and I bombed out of the pilot training on about the first of the major tests that we did on the old CT-4 air trainer, a little single engine prop trainer, and the system thought, maybe we could send you across and do. There's no slots available for navigator training, but we can put you on an air electronics officer's course that's just started. And they thought, hang on, they fly maritime. They fly Neptunes and P-3s. Okay, I'm in. So very quickly, I was over to the RAF base at East Sale to the School of Air Navigation, and then I spent the next year learning how to sit in the back of an aircraft and play with radars and radios and all that sort of thing, and then graduated in mid-79 as a brand-new shiny pilot officer, air electronics officer.
I'm just interested to know, and you can obviously say no to this, but what did the Air Force think were your failings as a pilot?
It was simply the hand and eye coordination bit. I was okay at the academic subjects were fine, and I was no star, but I was passing things. And then when you rejoin the circuit on the wrong one runway. On your scrub ride, they probably think time is up for you. Now, I had some issues with just the air work and coordination of 3D spatial orientation of where I was putting the aircraft. But ironically, though, for the higher level things like going out and doing aerobatics, I quite enjoyed that, and I was reasonably good at it. But that didn't have a lot of sort of accuracy in like instrument flying or anything. But it was the Or was that more technical, detailed stuff like circuits and instrument flying that saw me off?
Being the AEO, did you find that a lot of fun? Was that something that you found fulfilling?
Certainly. Just a very quick background. The P3 and indeed the Neptune before it, and the Nimrod, in fact, the back end consisted of both navigators and air electronics officers. The air electronics officers were essentially operated the acoustics and electronic sensors, the sonar systems, electronic warfare radar, that sort of thing. Whereas the navigator was more about getting the aircraft where it needed to be at any given time. And the tactical coordinator, who was the lead navigator, essentially, he essentially ran the mission. He was the mission commander. So as the central operator down the back, I was involved in using the sensors to try and find contacts, whether they be subsurface or surface contacts. And as the experience progressed, I then got to the role of what then was later called a sensor employment manager, which is basically the lead sensor operator on the crew, where you are one of the three key crew members, provide advice to the TACO and the captain on how to use the sensors down the back of the aircraft to the best extent. And so from that perspective, once I got to the stage of being a lead sensor operator / sensor employment manager, I was in a different area, and the job satisfaction was outstanding.
For the Orion, how long was a normal mission, and what sort of distance would it have been flying?
Well, that varies, obviously. I can say how long's a piece of string, but for a search and rescue or something at long range where it's imperative that a task gets done, you can be out there for the absolute, what's known as a prudent limited endurance, essentially as long as the aircraft and its fuel would take you. So the longest I've ever done, in fact, was an overnight transit from Guam in north of Australia to the Kiwi Air Force Base at Whenuapai in Auckland. And I was about 14 and a half hours, but that was mainly transit. However, I have been on a number of patrols in the Indian Ocean, Northern Pacific, where we've been sort of dragging it out to, 13 hours plus, that sort of thing. So it doesn't sound like much when you say it to a layman, but 13 hours in a 100-foot long metal tube is, and when you're bouncing around the sky and depending what it is you're doing, it can be a long time.
And I imagine the facilities are not much more than a chemical loo. And did you have a galley on there as well?
Well, the old Neptune, which I only, as I said, I only flew a couple of experience flights with the Air Training Corps, but the P3 was a step up from that. A pressurized aircraft, but it had a galley with a little dinette table with four seats, a couple of bunks, a nicely equipped a galley area with a food preparation area, a heating box for heating up frozen meals, a 40 cup coffee percolator, a small fridge about the size of your average little mini bar fridge. So we did all right as far as things like a couple of coffee meals, whatever. So it was actually quite a comfortable aircraft to fly in.
Wow, that sounds like luxury compared to something like a Shackleton.
Oh well, my brother spent a lot of time before he went to P3s. He spent a lot of time on the Neptunes, and yeah, you're right. So yeah, basically comparing a Lancaster to a 737. It's a bit the same sort of deal.
How much Soviet naval activity was there around Australia in the 1980s? I presume that was your primary role to monitor that.
That was probably the higher end role. We did quite a bit of that. We had a lot of other bread and butter stuff we did more locally. And so probably slightly more than half of what we did was more local things like exclusive economic zone surveillance, customs, search and rescue, that sort of thing. But we did a lot of general surveillance, pretty well centered on the Indian Ocean, Western and Northern Indian Ocean, South China Sea, Malacca Straits, Bay of Bengal, a little bit out to the east over the South Pacific, but that was more to do with monitoring fishing and resources for the South Pacific nations. But there was always a presence in the Southeast Asia area, primarily due to the fact that Russian or Soviet forces that needed to get to where things were occurring in the Indo-Pacific, they had to leave their ports in Vladivostok to get to places like the Gulf of Arabia or the Northwestern Indian Ocean. In reaction to American forces there, they had to go through the Southeast Asia area. So their standard transit route took them down past down past Japan, down past Taiwan, into the South China Sea. And at which point, a little bit of international law then takes over. So there were certain agreed shipping routes that would be used, and generally these forces, either submarines, surface ships, or submarines with surface escorts, would come through South China Sea into just south of Singapore, and then up into the Malacca Straits, where the water is pretty shallow, and you'd have to be a brave submariner to want to go in there submerged. And then they would transit up through that area, and then across the top of Sumatra, west across south of Sri Lanka, across to their operating area in the Northwest Indian Ocean. So what we would do, often just as Australian Maritime Patrol aircraft doing surveillance of the area, in our area of operation, which was Northern Indian Ocean, South China Sea, Malacca Straits area, we'd often do cooperative work with the Americans, where they would be tracking Soviet units from their P-3 elements that were coming flying out of places like QB Point in the Philippines or Guam. And when they got down to around the Singapore area, we would then take over the tracking of them on the surface at that stage. And then once they got to the top of the Malacca Straits heading west, that's when they were in a safe area where they could then submerge. If they were submarine, they would submerge and go covert. That's where we would then track them for a while, and then depending on the timing, we would then hand over to the US operating out of places like Diego Garcia or indeed QB Point, Philippines. So we're very much a partnership there. So a long answer to a short question, but yeah, the Soviets in our area were very much to the north of Australia, on their way from Vladivostok to where they needed to do stuff over in the Northwest Indian Ocean, and we had a role in tracking them in that area, and that was probably about 25% of our tasking in any given year, depending on the op tempo at the time.
Because you're posted to 10 Squadron,
that's right.
And I was fascinated to see one of your first missions is sort of archaeological.
Yes, just out of the blue. You may or may not have heard it, but there was a program, and I think it's still going, called Operation Drake, and it's a sort of a youth development program thing. And part of it was this group of young people that were doing various segments of a work on a square rigger sloop, whatever it was. I'm not heavily into sailing ship recognition, but called the Eye of the Wind. This thing was sailing around the world doing all sorts of projects with all these young kids on board as part of Operation Drake. One of which happened to be also searching for the supposed location of some cannon that Sir Francis Drake dumped overboard from the Golden Hind when he went aground on Vesuvius Ridge in Sulawesi, what's now Indonesia. Now, so we went up there, and there was a bit of a PR aspect to it, obviously, but we went up there and did a few photo passes. And And as luck would have it, I was actually on the station monitoring the magnetic anomaly detector, because that's really the only tool we could use, as long as the cannon were in fact iron rather than bronze. And we got some indications there was something there on the side of the reef, but it could have been some ballast that had been dumped overboard from a more recent shipwreck or whatever. We never knew, but we certainly got some indications that there was some metal on the side of the reef, but the local media, they beat it up a little bit and sort of said, "Oh, we found Jake's cannon," but I'm yet to be convinced. And that was 40 years ago, and no one's said no one gone up there to dig up Drake's cannon. But that's the sort of thing we did. But that was more of an aid to the civil community, public affairs, that sort of thing. But it was quite an enjoyable flight. We were talking to the ship, and we were dropping. dropping in little heli boxes to them. We were dropping magazines and local newspapers, Australian local papers and things to them just to sort of keep up the communication.
How were you dropping these things to them? Were they dropped into the sea and then they'd pick them up?
Yeah, it's very, very low tech. We've got these things that are known as helo boxes or heli boxes, and they're essentially just a cardboard box with orange and white stripes all over it with the top flaps of it, like any box that's got full flaps that fold over the top to close it. These things are held out open with pieces of string that are knotted to the bottom of the box. So when the box is thrown out into the slipstream, just the weight and balance of it, the flaps on the box turn into almost essentially rotor vanes and stabilize it, and it just eventually free falls down to the water. So you can put a couple of small things in it if you needed to. For a search and rescue, you do things like put a radio in it or that sort of thing. But it's very visible, easy to be picked up. In these cases, these things, they were picked up. They just went over there in their ribbon and picked it up and sort of waved at us and said hello and goodbye and off we went.
I'm learning a lot already.
So there you go. It's low tech. It was a cardboard. Essentially, we can chuck cardboard boxes over the door. You open the main cabin door and the guy stands there on the radio, on the intercom and on a count from the front end of the aircraft. You know, the size 9 boot just kicks it out the door.
But I'm presuming waterproofed cardboard or waterproofed in some way.
Well, to an extent. I've been on the receiving end of them once during a search and rescue survival exercise we did just south of Adelaide. And we were sitting in a dinghy. We had a couple of them launched towards us. And the contents survived. And we were lucky not to be hit by it because they came very close to the dinghy.
Shortly after that, you get a visit from RAF 617 Squadron Vulcan.
Yeah, this is not related to the maritime as such. It was simply the fact that the Australian branch of the Dam Busters Association, or whatever they call themselves, decided to have their annual reunion in Australia that year, and it was in Adelaide, and it coincided with Anzac Day on April the 25th. So in conjunction with that, 617 Squadron threw a Vulcan across, and a bunch of the old original 617 members, including quite a few guys on the dams raid, they turned up in South Australia and marched in the Anzac Day parade. And as a brand new young pilot officer on the squadron, we were basically ordered to go to this dining in night in the officers' mess for the 617 reunion, and we were more than happy to go. And as luck would have it, I got to sit next to Toby Foxley, who was an Australian. Bomb aimer on one of the aircraft. So he was on the Dan's raid, and chatting to him, it was fascinating. But they had a bunch of first aid covers that had been produced by the Leonard Cheshire Foundation as a fundraiser, with Bomber Harris's signature on them. And with the 1977 Queen's Jubilee stamp on them, and they were selling these things about $10 each at the dinner and other functions, and everyone that had them at the dining in night was just passing them around the table, getting loads and loads of signatures. So I still, one of my most treasured possessions from my whole time in the Air Force is this first aid cover with Bomber Harris's signature at the top, with the signature of about 20 members of 617, including about 10 members who were on the dams raid.
Wow.
That was incidental to the fact that we're maritime. That was just so happens to be at RAF Base Edinburgh in South Australia, and that's where they land.
Right. Must have been incredible speaking to somebody who'd actually participated in that raid.
I appreciated it at the time because I'd seen the movie, God knows how many times. And strangely enough, when I was at school, we had a school choir that we performed at speech night in front of these huge organ pipes at the Brisbane City Hall, and it was almost like the last night of the proms in Down Under. But we did the vocal version of the Dam Busters theme, and so I'd known about the Dam Busters since I was about 12 years old. So to actually meet these guys, but I look back at it now and think so many more opportunities and things I know about the Dams raid and later 617 raids now that I know. If I could ask these guys those same questions now, it'd be absolute heaven.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always amazed at the feat of navigation, of finding the target night at low level, across blacked out Germany, I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a difficult task, and as you'd expect, they didn't all make it. The majority got to the dams, but we had a couple of aircraft crash on the way, or got shot down. Les Munro had his issues and had to turn around and go back, so it was very costly. But as you said, the navigation at low level is hard at the best of times, but to do it in a single pilot, four engine, no autopilot bomber like a Lancaster, in those sort of circumstances, my hat goes off to those guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. I mean, with the Orion, I mean, how were you navigating over the ocean? Was GPS in use at that time?
Not then. Obviously, it is now. The aircraft has been upgraded over the years as there's improvements in navigation systems and sensor systems. The aircraft has been progressively upgraded. So, the original P3B model that we got in, I think, 1968, that was we on 10 Squadron on the nice computerized P3C, we used to call it the old steam-driven Bravo model, but they were pretty basic. They were down to the not much different to what the what crews in World War II would have been doing as far as navigation and manual track plots and auto track plots and dead reckoning and that sort of thing. But there were some of the early nav aids like Lorraine and Omega, which were They were cutting edge at the time, but they still weren't that easy to use. And it wasn't until really later on when GPS came in where suddenly you had this means that you pretty well knew when the aircraft was in any given time. But stepping back on, we had inertial systems, our aircraft. So we had twin inertials on the aircraft and they are very accurate, and they would drift like any gyroscopic system. They would have a bit of a drift, and that's where either the pilots looking out the window or myself on the radar, for instance, if we got something we could do an actual fix on, like a radar contact on a known position on a coast, a cape or an island or a rock or something, or the pilots would fly over a known position, the navigator could then update the inertials. And that would then slew the aircraft position back to that point, and then basically to a known position, and then away it'd go again. So INS, it's not GPS, but it was cutting edge at its time. And its advantage even today, though, is unlike GPS, which can be jammed, it can be turned off, whatever. Inertial is internal to the aircraft, absolutely internal to the aircraft. It's a bunch of whizzing wheels on a gyroscope system. It's not relying on signals coming from outside that can be jammed. So it's actually, from that perspective, it's a lot more secure.
I'm familiar with it on the Vulcan, where I'm a volunteer at the Avro Museum, and I do tours of the Vulcan, and I'm always fascinated by the precision of the instrumentation and how the inertial navigation system, how that it's all wheels and cogs in. There's no chips or anything.
No, the early they had computers, but the early analog computers literally revolved, little metal wheels and pulleys and rods and push bars and things, and they created just using analog inputs like that would then just output to a bunch of numbers appearing on a little counter on the screen that the navigator would use. And I'm not a navigator, but I know the principles behind a lot of this stuff. And once again, my hat goes off to these guys. They were using this sort of thing. And when you when you're over the middle of the Indian Ocean, heading to somewhere like Cocos Island or Diego Garcia to maintain your position, and then, you know, be told that, you know, there it is, we've got a visual on the, you know, on the nose in the aircraft in, you know, 20 miles. That's a great achievement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Did the crews use astral navigation as well, using sextant?
Yeah, certainly did. The navigator course, just step back one. When I did the Air Electronics Officers course, the AEO course, we did it in conjunction with the NAV. So all the core aviation officer training type subjects we trained together, and then the navigators went off and did their navigating specialist training, and the AEOs went off and did their little bit, and we graduated together. NAV got the little N wing, and we got the little AE wing. Astro was taught as part of the navigator course, and from my experience as an AEO student with a bunch of mates on the NAV course that we were living with and working with, a lot of their time on course was doing practice astro shots using the aerial sextants. They had at the NAV training school, they had little setups at the, in the courtyard of the NAV school, where they could mount the aircraft sextants in such a way, and then just go through the process of using the kit, but also the calculations involved and using the sight reduction tables. And it's like, you know, it's like doing high end mathematics using log tables. It's that sort of thing. So that the more they did it and practice over and over again, the better they could do. So yeah, so the P3 and the Neptune, they did in fact have a sextant mounted in them, just aft of the cockpit area between the navigator and the tactical coordinator was in the roof. So, they'd have a little step that you'd put down and a little red flag and say, don't go no further, otherwise you'll bark your ankles as you walk past. And they'd stand up there and they'd look at this little gyroscopic sextant through the ceiling and work out their positions. But more often than not, it was done as a practice thing, just to keep the state of the art going, their own skills. I wasn't particularly in any aircraft where it was astro navigation was used as a fallback option because everything else had failed. But I assume that did happen at the time.
It was one of my favorite features of the Vulcan that the fact that they were using a navigation technique from the 18th century of sailing ships.
Exactly.
In a 20th century aircraft, I just found mind blowing.
Yeah.
But it was more, I think, you know, it was in there from like the 1950s when they were designed,
yes,
when, you know, perhaps some of the inertial systems weren't as accurate, and it was a means for them to, you know, not get lost over the ocean.
Yeah, as the P3 has been developed over the years, and I don't know exactly when it was, but it might have been part of the major upgrade that occurred in about 99, 2000. I think at that stage it might have been where they took away the capability. Well, essentially, the capability is a sextant in a box that sits under a bench, and a hole in the roof. But the training at the DAB school ceased at about that time. So who knows? Yeah, time may tell. With jamming of GPS and other potential threats to NAV systems, satellite NAV systems. Who knows? We may see a rise of astro navigation again in the near future.
Dust down those log tables.
Oh yes.
When the Vulcan visited your base, did you get a chance to have a look at the Vulcan?
Yeah, I'd had a very quick look through it. I was sort of familiar with just from reading books and whatever, but I was sort of familiar with the general layout. But I've got to be honest, knowing that the Vulcan, as with the Dick the Tanker and others, they had an AEO on board as well, as did the Nimrod. So we had a bit of an affinity with our aircrew category. But when it occurred to me that the poor old guys out the back were the ones that didn't have the ejection seats, and only the pilots had the ejection seats, and you know, being an AEO on a V bomber, I thought, no, you can have that. I've just recently read Roland White's book about the Operation Blackbutt, and And he talks a bit about, obviously, about the development of the Vulcan and the whole issue with the ejection seats. And in fact, it was also in John Nicholls' book, Eject, 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 which I'm sure you're aware of, where he talks about the development of the ejection seat and the whole concept of having some of the crew not able to actually eject, but just have to go through the hole that's left behind by the pilots. Quite frankly, I think that sucks.
Yeah, they were supposed to exit the lower hatch rather than actually
climb out through
the pilot position. But yeah, did you go in the cockpit of the Vulcan and see how cramped it was?
Oh yeah, certainly did. I certainly did, and I was. Yeah, I was more interested, obviously, in the back end, sitting down in the seats with the route nav and the radar nav and the AEO and those guys. Oh, God, I mean, imagine sitting in. I just could not imagine sitting in that for, you know, heading from Ascension Island down all the way down to the Falklands and back. It'd be a shocker. It'd be a horrendous way to go to war, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. And also without a fridge, a galley, all the mod cons that you were used to.
Oh, absolutely.
And not even a proper toilet on board.
No, at least on the P3 we even had a door with a little vacant engage sign on it. So it was, which was only, it was a late model.
Luxury.
Yeah, in fact that only happened when we on one flight when we, you know, early 80s when we took the chief and the air staff and his wife on board on a trip to Japan, and someone thought, oh, maybe we should have a vacant engage sign on the toilet door because of the chief's wife. So that was a mod, locally made mod, and they put a bacon engage sign on the toilet door. It's been there ever since. Yeah.
Brilliant. So we sort of diverged away from where I was going, but I love going down rabbit holes.
Yeah.
But pretty early on in your 10 squadron career, you're monitoring a Soviet diesel submarine.
Yes.
Foxtrot.
Yeah, that was that's been around a couple of times, and there was another Zulu class at some stage, I believe, as well. But the Soviets had a couple of maybe more, I don't know, but diesel submarines that were essentially fitted out as oceanographic survey ships was the general story. But we did counted the, I know from early before my time that looking at the unit history, they'd been monitoring one of these up in North Queensland, I think. This particular one, they even had the name of it written on in Cyrillic across the sail. It actually had Mars, and I've got a photograph of it from the newspaper in my logbook. We used to love sending out photographs in the papers, but this thing had it was called Mars. And it was operating off West Australia, and the presumption, I believe, is it was doing a hydrographic survey of the approaches to places like Garden Island Naval Base in just near Perth, which is now Australia's submarine base. US submarines operate out of it, but at the time they would have been in there using it just to do surveys of the ocean bottom and contours and that sort of thing. There may be more to it. I wasn't aware of that, but I understand it was its primary role was the hydrographic survey vessel.
So to survey routes in for
their
submarines in the event of war.
Yeah. So they're operating outside territorial limits of 3 miles and that's quite legal. And they're in there and they're just beetling around. They're in there working out what the bottom contours are of the approaches. There's not a lot we can do to stop them in international waters.
Did you have many of the ubiquitous Soviet trawlers?
Quite often, actually. Even still today, actually it's more Chinese today, but during most of the major exercises, a couple of the big ones we did with the Americans over in the West, Operation Beacon Compass and Exercise Beacon Compass and Exercise Sandgroper out of Perth. I know a couple of those, but there was AGIs, so they were called the Auxiliary Intelligence Gatherers, AGIs operating out of there. On one of those exercises, USS Midway was operating with this carry battle group just off WA, West Australia. So it was there. I was aware that we had them operating off Queensland during Exercise Kangaroo 81, which I was involved in. Some interesting flying there, but they've certainly been around. But they were never regarded so much as a sort of real threat per se. More of a just sort of we've got our eyes on you and we know what you're doing. Okay, fine.
Can you talk to me about Operation Silent Pearl?
Yes. Well, Exercise Silent Pearl, although some people thought it probably should be Operation Silent Pearl. Now as part of our ongoing active maritime patrol cooperation with the Americans, we'd been exercising with them in Hawaii and Guam and the Philippines for decades after the war. And at the time I arrived on the squadron, this series of exercises had just commenced where we'd send a P-3 or two P-3s over to Hawaii to the Barbers Point Naval Air Station, which was their P-3 base at the time on Oahu, where we do two or three training missions operating against a US nuclear submarine just to get, just essentially to get our eye in, but also just to show the Americans that, we've got a rough idea what we're doing. And then once we got that squared away, we were using the US briefing system. So we go to the US Navy's Submarine Warfare Operations Center. We get briefings as a member of a U.S. Navy P-3 squadron. And then once they were happy with our performance, we would then be tasked on what were known as out-of-area sorties. So we'd fly north maybe 4 hours or so to out of Hawaii to North Pacific, to the west of California and British Columbia and that area, where at the time some of the less capable ballistic missile submarines, so the Yankees and maybe the early Deltas, but I think mainly the Yankees at this stage, were just operating as a patrol line with their nuclear missiles targeting U.S. Cities. And they were monitored 24/7 by the U.S. U.S. Navy, using not only P-3s tracking where they could, but there were other national means that I won't go into here that would have been used as well. But we were then slotted into their monitoring schedule. So we would then go up, typically would take over from a US Navy P-3 that was in contact, passive contact with a boomer that was submerged on patrol, going slow speed in a racetrack pattern. We would then monitor the sonar buoys that the Americans had dropped. And once they were happy that we had got the contact on those on our systems from their sonar buoys, they'd fly off, we'd then continue, and then we'd start dropping our own sonar buoys to track these ships. And in the early 80s, on the first couple of Silent Pearls that I did, we actually had quite a few contacts. We'd go up and on one of these out of areas, and we'd generally get a contact. But as the 1980s went through, my last one that I did was about 1987, and by then, I'm not sure the absolute circumstances, but it was probably a combination of the fact that later model Delta threes and other submarines and the length and the missiles they were using, they didn't really need to sit off the US coast to launch these things. They could sit back in Murmansk or Vladivostok and still hit their targets. But also, I don't know whether it was a will or as it was getting closer to Glasnost or whatever, but we were going out on a few of these sorties and essentially getting no contact. We were going out on, quote, historical data, and we'd go out there with beetle around 3 or 4 hours and find nothing, and then recover into California or Comox in British Columbia, and they'll have a 24-hour stop over there, and then fly back to Hawaii the next day. So it was called Exercise Silent Pearl, in that we are doing training with U.S. Navy, but it involved actually doing an operation where we are tracking an operational Soviet boomer on patrol against the U.S. target.
With a nuclear missile submarine, obviously their main aim, one of their purposes is to remain undetected. So
more often than not, we're taking over contact that was already had. I wasn't particularly on any cruise where we went out looking for them and then found them. We were generally taking over. But essentially, nuclear submarines, things have changed now as things have developed, and I've been out of the out of the information cycle for this one for a while, but at the time, nuclear submarines, just by dint of the fact that they had had pumps that are operating at high speed and cooling pumps and that sort of thing, and electronic services, they had a lot of high frequency frequencies that were easily detected, whereas a diesel submarine operating on battery was a lot quieter. There were elements of the submarine's signature, various frequencies of sounds that they would emit that we knew, that we had intelligence on, that we would track them on those frequencies. And you could do all sorts of things. So by, if you had a, you know, using a Doppler effect, if you had an emission of a known frequency from a particular pump or whatever, if suddenly that frequency increased slightly or decreased slightly, and depending on how it was in relation to other sonobuoys around it, you could actually deduce whether the thing had gone past a sonobuoy using a Doppler effect or whether it had turned towards another buoy, away from another buoy. So you could actually track these things fairly accurately on Doppler shifts you could say, like, you know, turn left on this buoy and then that would then cue you to where you're going to drop your next pattern of sonobuoys. It was a very low tech solution, which really came out of the 1950s, using essentially passive sonobuoys with no directional capability, but just using the Doppler effect and being able to measure the changes in the frequency based on their movement, where you could quite clearly ascertain where they were moving. So we used that, and that's. That was my experience. So we didn't actually detect them per se. We went there. We were taking over contacts from others. They'd say, look, we got a detection on this particular source at this frequency. It's on sonobuoy number such and such, and we would then monitor that buoy. Yeah, we got it, and then we'd drop our own buoys around it, so we'd got contact on our sonobuoys, and away we'd go.
Yeah, because obviously I'm basing my knowledge on watching Hunt for Red October too many times to mention.
There's never too many times to watch Red October.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. Another fan. That's what I like to hear.
I read Hunt for the Red October and Red Storm Rising in a P3 over the course of one month deployment to Butterworth. a little bit cheesy at times in both books, but quite entertaining.
Absolutely. What sort of weaponry was your P3 packing?
Well, on these missions, we weren't going in there armed for war. We weren't carrying any warshot, whatever. We were in there to start World War III on behalf of the Americans by any means. If it was for real, the P3 could carry a number of lightweight homing torpedoes, Mark 44, then the Mark 46, something, and the other Mark 54. I can't remember the new one that's just been developed. There's even a new torpedo that's being used with the P8 Poseidon, which is the 737 derivative that replaced the P3, which they can actually drop that from fire level and using GPS, and it will then home to a position where its sonar homing would then work in order. So so they can do end submarine warfare attacks from high level, which is bizarre. So we carry those, typically, you might carry, four in the Bombay. I think the Bombay could carry eight. I think I may be wrong there, but four in the Bombay, they're not as big as a submarine torpedo. They're about a 13 inch or something diameter, something like that anyway. Whereas the Mark 48 the Mark 8s that HMS Conqueror use, I think they're about 21 inches diameter. So they're a much smaller torpedo. But they pack quite a punch. They've got a good homing capability. So we'd add that capability. The Americans had, I think it's probably their more primary weapon against nuclear submarines, particularly boomers, would have been the nuclear depth of bombers, which I believe the Royal Air Force had in the Nimrods, capable in the Nimrods as well. So no more of a, you drop it in, the rough area where the boat is, and you're pretty likely to get a hit.
Yeah, we've got a Nimrod cockpit at the Avro Museum, and I'm always fascinated by the big red button on the joystick, marked N.
Yes.
With a cat over the button on the on the Nimrod joystick, Mark, then?
We had a Nimrod visiting our base at Edinburgh many, many years ago, and I took a bunch of my civilian friends there to have a look over the, we had an air show there, but at the same time. And I took a couple of my civilian friends there, and we showed them around the Nimrod. I'd actually gone for a quick flight a couple of days before in the Nimrod that was over there. And we're looking around the TACO station on this aircraft, and they had a number of panels that had brown paper or old paper bags or something with masking tape stuck over a couple of panels. And one of my civvy mates, who just looked, is that where they dropped the nukes from? Is it? I said, I've got no idea, mate. So, people are stupid. The Australian P3s were, they originally had the capability taken away to, we didn't have the appropriate boxes and everything, to drop the nukes for obvious reasons, but the American P3s, did.
There's so many things in your, history here that you've sent me, which I'm fascinated about, but, tell me about Operation Caterpillar.
So Operation Caterpillar, well, it's actually a two-part thing there. That's Operation Caterpillar and 6 months later, Operation Endquarter. They have some great names for these operations. I think wasn't the Falklands
Better
Operation.
Than Kangaroo, which seems to be the only name that Australia can have for a big exercise.
Well, the big exercise of the Americans is now up in more recent years, but that went from kangaroo to being crocodile. tell us about it. Let's think. The Falklands, were Operation Corporate. Where did that guy come from? So Operation Caterpillar, these things presumably come out of a random number generator book, a random name book. Anyway, we went to Cocos Islands in the Indian Ocean, about 4 hours flying time west of central Western Australia. The Soviets were doing trials for the development of the Buran space shuttle. I'm sure you'd be aware of. And as part of those trials, they used an old lifting body that they developed, I think, in the '60s, which I think they in turn pinched from the Americans, the Spiral, I think they called it. But they used that as a test bed to mount the heat dissipating tiles, to trial them. So it wasn't a mini Buran space shuttle by any means. It was just a little lifting body, re-entry vehicle, but they put the tiles on the bottom. So the trials, from Australia's perspective, we monitored two of these launch recoveries, and one was in, I think it was June 82, and then which was Operation Caterpillar, then March 83, it was Operation Endquarter, and that was the second one. They were basically the same sort of operation. So through whatever strategic means were made available, we were aware, we're aware that the splashdown was going to occur at a location near the Cocos Islands in a given time frame, and the means were there to give a heads up when the launch had actually occurred, and they gave a window for when the re-entry would occur. So in both cases, there was quite a reasonably sized Soviet recovery group turned up for the operation. There was on one of them, I can't remember which is which, but there was a Cashman class DDG, there was a Kara class cruiser, the Sobny, I think, was a Krivat. There was they had support ships, logistics support ships, a couple of space event ships. The Chumikin was one of them, just a ship with a big golf ball on top. And there was the Goyogi Dobrovolska, I think it was one of these other ones with a couple of antennas sticking out the top of it. So they had quite a sizable force there. Now, we had a twofold interest there. We were interested in monitoring the re-entry and the recovery through obviously intelligence purposes, but also, you've got a bunch of Soviet ships in the area and a bit of a smorgasbord of things we can collect acoustics intelligence and electronic intelligence from. So it was a two-pronged approach. So we had the intelligence collection for the actual recovery, but also the intelligence collection for the force, more of a tactical level thing. So we went out there and we dropped sonobuoys near these ships and just got the latest acoustic the signatures of them where we could, took lots of photographs. One or two of the ships had hormone helicopters on board, KA-25 helos on board, and they're flying interference on us a few times to try to prevent us getting too close. But on the appointed day, I wasn't actually on the crew at the time, but on the appointed day, the guys were told, heads up, it's inbound. And as luck would have it, on both occasions, our crews managed to get in there and get some sort of fantastic photography of the lifting body in the water, and as its whole recovery sequence as it's been loaded onto the ship, as it's been hosed down, decontaminated, whatever. And some of those photographs were, a couple of them ended up on a display, a cold water display in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., at the National Aerospace Museum. I think it's not there now since they've upgraded the display. But, I was actually quite surprised one day to see one of these photos. But that was probably, I'd have to rate that as some of the most satisfying flying that I'd done on the whole time on maritime. It was busy flying. We're there for a couple of weeks. Cox Island's a lovely place to visit for a couple of weeks. It's a very unspoiled little island, a little atoll. To fly against what we are flying against, but then getting the ability to get the intelligence and take the photographs of this, a very time sensitive event of a splashdown of a Soviet test article, was quite an intelligence coup. And whilst I wasn't actually on the crew that took the photography at the time, we're about an hour or two out, by the way, I was certainly proud to be part of the whole thing.
They are incredible photos. And I hadn't realized the Soviets sort of landed some of their spacecraft in the sea. I always thought they were, trying to land them on the steps in, land-based locations.
Yeah, I think those two, I can't remember them, the Cosmos, whatever the numbers were, the vehicle was called the BOR-4. And I understand that the future trials, this is post- post-Cold War open source investigation on my part, but essentially the later development and trials were done overland, and they didn't want to, all these Australians and Americans and Kiwis all flying around them trying to annoy them while they're trying to recover under their lifting bodies.
It's incredible, because I've seen photos of sort of the remains of one of these Burans in Russia. And it's very much like the space shuttle.
Yeah,
the US space shuttle.
A few little differences. I think they actually had engines, that air breathing engines that they could use at some stage on them, but they're basically designed. But and I only learned this relatively recently that they did in fact fly them in space on a couple, but at least one or two occasions, and unmanned. But one of them I actually saw it in Sydney. It was doing I think it was just after the fall of the Soviet Union. It was a bit of a money making thing. They were trying to go around the world and try to get a bit of hard currency for the former Soviet Union. But I saw the brand was in a large overgrown circus tent sort of thing down on the on Sydney Harbour on display. And it's $20 to get in to have a look and take photos. I think we couldn't take photos. Yeah. So, but I understand the last one that was remaining collapsed in a hangar. There was a snowstorm or something, and I think that there was too much snow on the roof of the hangar, and the whole thing just collapsed on it and destroyed it.
Now, round about this time, you had an engine failure incident as well.
There was a couple over the years, but there was. There was one just out of Darwin where it was the first time I'd actually ever been told to set condition 5 for ditching. But we were at low level flying past a Taiwanese fishing boat, just taking photographs. And we normally on those sort of flights, we'd have one of the engines shut down just for fuel conservation. And it was already shut down. And as we went past it, and I was sitting on the radar station, sensor station 3 at the time, and I remember feeling a sort of little boot in the backside that you get as there's a bit of yaw when you shut down an engine. And and what had happened is number 4 engine, the outer starboard engine, it just shut down. And we're about 150 feet or something on this rigging run. And at that point, the front end said, you know, crew set condition 5 ditching. And I was, you know, trying to throw your shoulder straps over your shoulder without the buckle smashing the radar. It's a bit of a challenge. But we climbed away. Well, like within 30 seconds or so, they managed to, so we got the number one engine restarted. And then we just recovered back to Darwin. But there was certainly, there was a little bit of tucker factor there very briefly. There was another event coming back from a deployment we did for about a week in Okinawa. We came back via Manila who were picking up some people who had been attending a conference at QB Point. And on approaching to Manila International, we're on a long final on the ILS. And then next minute I just hear through the public address system, Mayday, or through the radio, Mayday, 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 engine fire. You know, so they actually declared a Mayday. They got an engine fire indication on one of the engines, and then pumped the fire bottle into it, and then the alarm still continued. Then they pumped the adjacent one, which you can feed the fire systems from one engine to the next one across by one, and they pumped that into it and made no difference. And then we landed. It turned out it was more of an instrumentation error. There was one of the, can I just hold for a second? I've got a cocker spaniel gun berserk.
Could you
just
hold? Sure.
Yeah. I'll just,
don't worry.
God knows what that was about. He's barking his head off like an idiot. Cocker spaniels, they're stupid. Idiot.
Don't worry, Lee. I've had far worse.
No, he's good. He's great. Sid. Nate, we call him Sid. It's either named after, we can't decide whether he was named after Sid Vicious or Sid James. I think he covers both faces.
Yeah. Sid James would be good.
Yeah. Oh, so what, where were we?
In Mayday, where, but it was instrumentation.
When we landed, they indicated that there was a fault in the fire warning system, but we still had to get all the fire bottles recharge and everything. And it was very handy that on the opposite side of Manila Bay, there was QB Point Naval Air Station. So they flew over a crew, maintenance crew from the US Navy and threw some spares in. So over after an overnight in Manila that we hadn't planned on, we headed back to Australia. And so that one was, it's one of those ones where you don't know at the time. An emergency is declared and you think, oh God, what's happening? For about a minute or so, but you know, luckily it all panned out. You know, there was no real risk, but you don't know that at the time.
Now, I don't have many guests on Cold War Conversations that have been involved in causing a diplomatic incident.
Yeah. Oh, well, I didn't cause it. No. We're on about 1980s. Six, I think it was. We're on one of our many bread and butter Australian fishing zone patrols that we used to do. We used to call it fish exits. So basically, we just fly around the Australian coast, an overnighter in Perth, and then an overnighter at Learmonth in northwest Australia, an overnighter in Darwin, an overnighter in Townsville, and then you come back. It's about a week, and you're just looking for illegal fishing boats and that sort of thing. And on this particular one, we're flying down the Queensland coast, and we saw the Alexander Pushkin. One of the CTC line cruise liners that they've been advertising cruises on television in Australia for quite a while, and we thought, oh, cruise ship, you know, that's red rag to a bull. So we went down and did the standard allowed what we call a rigging run. We'd fly down one side, take photographs, and then fly down the other side, take photographs at low level, and then a run across the stern. But as it turned out, the captain of the ship took exception to this, and he immediately complained to his hierarchy, who presumably complained to the Soviet foreign ministry, who then presumably complained to the Australian embassy in Moscow, and then diplomatic notes were passed, and then the next morning we were told, look, yep, the departure's delayed, the aircraft captain and TACO are required to go make a couple of phone calls and do it, please explain. We downloaded all the sortie records and all the data of our navigation data with the altitude and the photographs. And it turned out that we had not in fact breached anything as far as the height or proximity to the ship. And so essentially my understanding is the Australian government went back to the Soviet government and said, international orders, They were doing what their job was, and take a hit.
Just a fuss about nothing, really.
Well, for one of these things when you don't know what's as we're waiting for the download of the navigation data, we were sort of looking very closely at the altitude as we went past the stern. That might have been we don't know, but as it turned out, the numbers on the printout didn't lie. We're okay there. My bigger concern there was probably the fact that they'll probably had, a lot of these cruise ships, they have things like play pigeon shooting off the stern and that sort of thing. So I was more concerned about that, I guess.
Yeah. Bit of grape shot in your tail. That wouldn't have been a good look.
No, not a lot. No.
Operation Gateway is quite a long-standing operation. I think in your notes you said it started in 1981. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, just a very brief background. We'd been monitoring over the decades, post-war, Soviet and other activities in the Southeast Asia area. But more often than not, we would fly up there on a scheduled, 1 to 2 week deployment. Scheduled in advance, and we you'd arrive and be told, you missed an SSGN that went past last week, and there's a Soviet arms carrier going next week. But you would have gone home by then. And somewhere along the line, someone decided that wouldn't be a better idea if we actually had a standing deployment there that could in fact respond to contacts as they arose, And that suggestion, from my understanding, had been around for quite some time. But in about 80, 81, I understand that there's a bit of more detail about this in the book Cold War Warriors that probably mentioned later on, where part of Australia's diplomatic response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, sanctions and whatever, part of that was there was a change in their posture of creating this standing detachment in Butterworth in Malaysia. And it was primarily set up as a bilat between Malaysia and Australia, where we would be providing them training on maritime patrol and surveillance and that sort of thing. But it was very much involved in providing a presence in the area, with a response capability if it was required as a diplomatic message. So that, I think it was about February 81, I think rings a bell, was the first Gateway sortie, number 11 squadron on the old steam driven P3Bs, I think flew the first Gateway sortie. And it was one of those things that you did, three or four times a year. You'd go up there, for 3 weeks, 4 weeks at a time. Sometimes you wouldn't see a lot. Other times you'd get some really good flying. You'd have what we call prosecutions, where there'd be a Soviet submarine would be transiting the Malacca Straits, and you'd react to that. You'd go into a higher tempo flying. On other times, you just do a standard rotation of every couple of days, every 2 or 3 days, you'd just fly another standard route. Checking out radar contacts out to the west and in the south, join the sea and further south. That operation is still ongoing. It's changed quite a bit, obviously, over the years. I'm not sure how many. I think they may only have one aircraft, one crew there now, and there's certainly different priorities of what we're looking for up there, and what diplomatic and military strategic purposes is for being there. Would it changed? And we've had it's been publicised in the news. We've had the RAF's P-8 Poseidons on a number of occasions now, flying routes essentially that we've flown for decades in the South China Sea, but being challenged by Chinese and Chinese ships and aircraft. That's a bit of a different dynamic to it now. But essentially, what you're seeing now with P-8s flying in freedom of navigation flights around the South China Sea is the same operation that started in 1981. As a response to both providing a more responsive maritime surveillance capability in the region, but also partly as a diplomatic response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So it's been going for, what is it now? It's, 43 years now. It's quite amazing.
That's quite a length of time. I mean, you mentioned China there. How much of a threat was China perceived as during the Cold War?
Well, from my perspective, really never. We never had anything to do with them in our area in the Indian Ocean, South China's area. There were one or two occasions where Chinese satellite tracking groups were in the South Pacific monitoring either the launches or recovery of satellites, which I think there were some responses there. I can't remember when or where they were, but that was more of just response to, you know, scientific activities. But certainly there was no, at no time when I was flying in that region, was there any, in the back of my mind, did I have any sort of thought, oh God, the Chinese. We had, you know, our standard priorities, target or contact of interest priorities, which, you know, things like Soviet forces, but we're also very interested in, you know, in regional development. So we're interested in, you know, getting Vietnamese ships were going around the area. We had an interest in monitoring the procurement of a couple of German Type 209 submarines by Indonesia back in the early 80s. I was on a sortie where we were getting photography of a couple of ex-Dutch destroyers, you know, the Van Schip destroyers, which are basically the river class Leander types, and they'll be handed over to Indonesia. So we went out to look at those before they went into service with Indonesia as they left their transit port at Sri Lanka on the way in. So we had an interest in other things, but really China really never popped up as a major, you know, threat's probably the wrong word to use, but of a target of interest or a contact of interest.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. You leave P3s in December 87. I mean, what would you say was your highlight of your P3 experiences?
Oh, I think I mentioned earlier on, if I look back on it now, probably the most satisfying flying I did was either during Operation Endquarter, you know, when we were monitoring the Soviet re-entry vehicle. But I'd have to also toss in there tracking, you know, I think it was in 1981 on one of the Silent Pearls when we actually had hot contact on a Soviet, I think it was a Yankee class, might have been an early Delta, I'm not sure, but one of the two. But I do recall we were tracking one of those at the time. And at the time, I didn't really think of it as a big deal, but I look back at it now and think, you know, here was me as a 20-something Australian over the North Pacific on behalf of the Americans monitoring, a dozen or so, you know, thermonuclear weapons pointed at American cities. It's quite an awesome, awesome responsibility and circumstances to be in. And the fact that the Americans trusted us to be part of the operations to track those, I think, is a kudos on the Australian Defence Force that I think has been pretty understated over the years. It's sort of up there in many ways with, you know, that your most trusted secrets with, you know, the Five Eyes signals intelligence environment is one area, and the trust needed to share secrets at that level, but to the trust needed to allow, you know, dang foreigners to monitor a threat to your nation, i.e. America, is it's pretty daunting.
I certainly wasn't aware that the Royal Australian Air Force had been involved in operations in that area. So that was a fascinating part for me. I just want to ask you about some of your post P3 career, because there's some interesting bits in here, and we're sort of stepping a little bit outside the Cold War. But so September 93, you're a submarine observer.
Yes.
On HMCS Ojibwa.
Yes.
Now, what's it like to be on the other end?
Well, I jumped at the chance to do that. I got a phone call from one day from one of my old squadron mates who was working in headquarters operation command at the time. And you may not be aware, it's a bit in abeyance at the moment. I think there's talks to resurrect it. But there, for many years, there was the annual Fincastle Trophy competition. So it was an anti-submarine warfare competition between the old Commonwealth nations, so essentially Royal Air Force, Royal Australian Air Force, Kiwis and the Canadians. And we'd rotate, the host would rotate through the years, and the host country would, apart from New Zealand, obviously, would provide the target submarine. And in this particular year, I was in a mind-numbingly boring staff job in Canberra, and I got this phone call and said, look, Lee, do you want to be, what's the chance of being interested in becoming getting deployed to 92 wing for the Fincastle. Well, where is it this year? Canada. I go, I'll have a word to the group captain. So I had a word to my fighter pilot group captain. I said, look, he said, yeah, go for it. So essentially, each nation provides observers in the other competing nation's aircraft to keep them honest, but also one nominated country, in this case Australia, got to provide the submarine observer. So I put my hand up for that and said, yeah, I'm in. So on arrival, delayed arrival at Greenwood, Canadian Forces Base in Greenwood in Nova Scotia, which interestingly was my big brother flew on exchange with the Canadians on Auroras there about 20 years before. We flew to, a Canadian crew flew me down to Boston, and then I joined Ojibwa at the Charleston Shipyard, which is right next to where the, I think it's USS Constitution is docked, was doing a maintenance at the time. So off we went on Sunday morning out of Boston Harbour on the surfacing, slowly going out in amongst all the fishing boats and pleasure boats and crab pots and crab floats in the water in this Canadian Oberon class boat. And then, we're basically submerged for about 8 days, during the competition. So each country would send an aircraft out to, on a set scenario to track the boat in a competition, scenario. And my job was to be in the ops room and make sure that they were doing the right thing and putting their periscopes up when they needed to, and, offering options for, opportunities for detection when they were as per the rules. But eight days on one of those boats, which isn't that much different from a Type 7 U-boat, I must say. I think it was probably based on the Type 7 or the Type 21 at least. A little bit whiffy. A lot of diesel fumes and whatever. We stopped. We went to the surface once during the whole period where there was a medevac where one of the sailors had to be winched off, and a Canadian, one of the, I can't remember what they call them there, little Canadian twin-engine helicopter Sea Knight thing, but it's all bright yellow, that came out and flew over the top and hovered over there and took this guy away. And I thought that was quite spectacular. And then very reluctantly, we all went back down below again, and off we went for another 4 days. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad when it was over. I left after the base. I had a couple of days off in Halifax in Nova Scotia, and I went to all my favourite pubs that I've haunted before and had a great time. It had the longest showers, baths, that I've ever had in my life, because it's 8 days with no shower, stinking of diesel fumes. that was great. It was great fun. Glad I did it.
Must have been really interesting seeing it from the other, the other end of things.
It was, yes.
I'm delighted to see that you worked with one of my guests, Sue Boyd from episode 151. How on earth did that happen?
Well, that was just
you know, the fact that she turned up on your episode, Rhonda, I was just listening to the latest episode on that day in the car driving to wherever I was driving to. But that's Sue Boyd. No, I was posted into, I applied for it. I was posted into the job as Australian Defence Advisor in Suva, in Fiji, responsible for Fiji and Samoa, Tonga, and a couple of other South Pacific nations. The Sue was the High Commissioner at the time. And I must say, she initially thought, an Air Force person coming into this job, but Fijians have only got an army and a navy. And I had to remind her that I was there representing the Australian Defence Force, not the Royal Australian Air Force. So we just got on fine. Sue was a bit of a hoot at times. Interesting person to work for. But I was aware of her previous experiences in earlier postings. And I'd actually only just before that episode, I'd actually seen her book in our local bookshop here at Noosa. And I might get that. Sorry, I had to read. I didn't get a mention, but my predecessor did. The Navy commander that was in the job before me, he got a mention, not by name now. It was fascinating to hear that story, hear her adventures of, I think she was in East Germany, East Berlin at the time. And interestingly, her deputy in Fiji was Margaret Toomey. She then went on to be the Australian ambassador in Russia. That would have been sort of the late 2000s.
Lee, if the listener wants to understand more about P3 operations with the Royal Australian Air Force, what's the best place to go to for that?
There's plenty of stuff online. So if you just looked up number 10 Squadron RAF or 11 Squadron RAF, you'd find eventually go down the Wikipedia rabbit holes. You'd find all sorts of things, Operation Gateway. More recently, there's been a book produced called Cold War Warriors, which provides a quite a good account of P3 operations in the RAF from the late 60s through to, I think, 90, 91, 90, 90, 92. And that was published by the Air Force History and Heritage Branch, who have an ongoing program of history, Air Force history publications. And that was one of the ones that came out a couple of years ago in conjunction with the 100th anniversary of the RAF. That's by, Ian Pearson. Cold War Warriors. So if you did a search on that, you'd find it. There's others specifically about the RAF in the Cold War from the maritime perspective. There's not really that many. There's every now and then you read a book and you find a one liner in it that might mention it briefly. There's the official histories, but the official histories don't cover that area yet. That'd probably be my main one for the Cold War period, but from an earlier period, the RAF's maritime patrol has an unending or unbroken record from 1939, where we sent number 10 Squadron over to the UK to pick up the nice shiny new Sunderlands to bring them back to Australia. And then, unfortunately, the war broke out, and so the Australian government said, 10 Squadron, you guys can stay there and fly with the Coastal Command for the next 6 years. So 10 Squadron was flying throughout the war in Sunderlands, and there's a couple of good accounts on that. One called Maritime is Number 10 by Kevin Bass. There's another account of RAF 461 Squadron Sunderlands. They Shall Not Pass Unseen by Neville Shute, who wrote On the Beach, and which is a very famous Cold War fiction story. Other than that, there really isn't that much that covers that part of the story.
I'll provide links to those suggestions in the episode notes so that people can follow up on that. And Lee, I'm really pleased to see that you are an oral history interviewer yourself, and fascinated to see that you're Korean War, Vietnam War veterans, and Australia's role in the Vietnam War is quite often forgotten.
Yeah, so that came as a bit of a sort of an accident, just one of these examples of mission creep. I came into the History and Heritage Branch when I transferred from the Permanent Air Force to the Reserve in 2015,
And I was asked to help out initially with doing some interviews with the Army as well. What the Army call a history field team or field history team, where we deployed to our base in the UAE and I essentially did a number of interviews with current serving RAS members who are on operations as part of the air task group that was operating there at the time against ISIS. And then I went back and did it again 12 months later. So on the strength of all the interviews that I did then with folks who were including the CO of one of the F-18 squadrons just after he came back from a 9-hour sortie strapped into a bang seat, on the strength of that, we were approached at our branch by the Australian branch of the Bomber Command Association, who were keen to get a number of interviews captured by a number of their members who were, sadly, fewer and fewer each year. So I put my hand up for that one, and I ended up within about a 2 or 3 month period, I interviewed about a dozen of these chaps, and I've interviewed quite a few of them since. And that led me from these Bomber Command chaps into other World War II RAF veterans, then interviewing a number of RAF veterans from Vietnam who were involved in air operations, flying Caribous, Canberra bombers, ground defence officers like the RAF Regiment, but the Australian Air Force. So I did a number of interviews with those folks, a couple with Korean War. So it's been probably the most interesting part of my new life in the Air Force Reserve. And I've got about another 2 years to go before they forcibly, send me down as my age extension expires. So I'm quite enjoying it. I hope it continues as long as we've got people to interview and are willing to be interviewed.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's always great to speak with a fellow oral historian. And obviously the aim of this podcast is to try and capture as many of these stories as we can whilst people are still around.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.